May it please the court. I would like to stress 2 points on this appeal today. First, having to do with the court's finding on the refusal of tender. Secondly, with respect to damages. The court held that Mr. Mengelt refused a tender. Assuming for the moment that there was a tender, and there never was because there was nothing more than an offer that was made.
Are you sure that's what the court held?
Yes.
It didn't hold it. It was simply a statement of intention to tender?
No, the court did not hold that. Well, I'm saying that it was nothing more than a statement. The court held that it was a tender. But since a tender can never occur without an unconditional payment of money, I don't believe that the court could make that finding, but I believe our briefs adequately address that point.
So the fact is the court uses both terms, right? One on page 8, one on page 14.
That is correct.
So it's an arguable point.
Yes. With respect to the refusal, the court held that there was a refusal. There's nothing in the record that shows that there was a refusal of tender. The cases say that it has to be reasonably clear that a refusal amounts to show that there would be a vain, idle, useless act, or that it would be a futile act to make a tender. In this case, there's nothing in the record which shows that the actual making of a payment would have been rejected. All we have is a conversation in this case where a lawyer and Mr. Mengelt discussed a number, and Mr. Mengelt stated what he would like. He didn't say, I will refuse anything if you send me the correct amount. The only cases that have been cited, there was an actual tender which was rejected, and there was a statement after a hearing in court where the attorney for the party absolutely stated unconditionally that they would refuse to accept a check. That did not happen in this case. There is absolutely nothing in this record.
What did he say?
Excuse me?
What did he say?
Mr. Mengelt said that he, after waiting for all those years...
No, what did he say? We don't. We'll
all he said was he thought that it would be fair if he received $200,000.
Well, doesn't that say then that I'm not accepting? Did he ever accept it?
It was never
offered to him?
Nothing was ever delivered.
Was it offered to him in writing?
An offer in writing is not a tender.
I didn't ask you that. Was it offered to him in writing in the amount of $55,000?
There was a letter which said, on an unspecified date, we would pay you, we are willing to pay you $55,000 plus interest.
Which was the amount of the interest that they negotiated, is that right?
No, it is the amount of interest which was due under the note.
Well, that's right.
Yes.
And that just didn't come out of the air.
There was a letter that said, we offer to make this payment.
At $12,000,
that's
12%.
Correct. And in Ortman versus Kane, the court held that that was not a tender. An offer to make a payment is not a tender, does not constitute tender.
As I understand it, that, whatever you want to call it, that suggestion, was that 2 years after the note had expired?
It was more than 2 years after the note had matured.
And that was a renewed note, was it not?
It was...
Wasn't there a renewed note with different interest? I sort of lost track of the...
It was, as I recall, these notes, there was a series of business relationships, and this was the last debt that was owed, and it was put into a...
The last debt that was agreed upon that was owed,
yes.
And that was the... And that was at, a, what, 12%?
It was a 12% interest.
And had a due date at a certain time?
That's correct. It was due more than 2 years before these conversations had arisen. That's correct. There is nothing in the record that would suggest that Mr. Mengelt would not have taken the payment. He never did anything tangible or intangible to say that he would refuse the payment. He certainly asked for more money. And, in fact, there were further conversations in the record to discuss it, which the court rejected any of these conversations. The court felt that this was a refusal. There was nothing more to talk about.
Do you define this as a settlement offer, a settlement of a dispute, as opposed to the offer to pay on a note?
I don't see any distinction between making an offer 2 years after a note and the note itself, which is nothing more than an offer to pay a debt.
So you don't think this is something new, that they didn't pay the note, he's held stock in security, and now the debtor is coming forward saying, I'll pay you what we owe under the note, at the regular interest rate, only extended 2 years.
All it is another promise to pay.
To pay the full amount of the interest on the old note that had expired.
As if it had been extended
2 years.
He promised to pay what was due on the note.
Note were extended 2 years.
Even if it weren't, he was promising to pay what was due on the note, but it's nothing more than a promise to do something in the future. It is not a tender. A tender means an unconditional payment. It's not an unconditional promise to pay, because he already did that once.
Are you trying to sell us on the idea that he would have accepted it had he handed it to him?
I don't think he would have had the choice.
I didn't ask you that. Answer me directly.
Oh, yes, he would have taken it.
That's what you're trying to argue.
Yes, absolutely. With respect to the damages, I would say that the damages are based totally on speculation. This is a situation where there was restricted stock, and in order for there to be a sale of the restricted stock, the restriction would have to be removed. We provided evidence to the court that this particular block of stock, at the same time that the shares of this stock were restricted, the plaintiffs attempted to lift the restriction on similarly situated stock. And the stock restriction was not lifted for 9 months. In addition to which, we also provided the court with evidence that the company had no intention of selling the stock. It said so in the depositions that we provided to the trial court, and it was very specific that not only didn't they have an intention to sell the stock, but they also stated in their deposition that they never tried to sell the stock, which they could have sold. And it seems to me that when there is no damage with respect to an asset, when the party doesn't have a triggering event in mind, that there was no loss of value, because it is the plaintiff in this case had no intention of disposing of the stock. It said so 5 different times. And you know, whether or not this was a stock manipulation and they could have sold the stock, it seems to me that if the court is going to find my client liable for the consequences of its actions, that the plaintiff has to show that something would have happened. And unfortunately, in this case, the trial court speculated that certain things were going to happen. It speculated that the plaintiff was going to move to lift the restriction, and that it would have. And the court determined that it would have taken 2 weeks because it only took 2 weeks in another situation. But in the situation we showed, it took 9 months.
What perplexes me in this case is that if you say, well, if they come up with the money, you would have had to have taken it and it would have given back the stock, right?
Absolutely.
And what I'm confused about is that his initial reaction was, hey, I could have used that money the last 2 years and made a lot more on it. That's a late payment, and I should get more than that. Now you're saying that isn't what he said.
No, that he certainly said it.
Well, why is that not a refusal of a settlement offer as opposed to whether or not he really meant to pay?
A settlement offer is irrelevant in a question
not,
of
not
tender.
Irrelevant if you're talking about if there had been a settlement at a certain point, and then there's a question, you take whatever you agree to settle and you give back whatever security you had held.
This is a question of tender. I had a case personally a year ago.
Is this in the court record?
No.
Let's keep it up.
Okay.
All right, that's all I need to know.
There's a distinction between discussions of settlement and tender. A tender requires, as the court said itself, the tender requires unconditional payment of money. It doesn't mean an unconditional promise to pay. We already had an unconditional promise to pay when they signed the note. They made an unconditional promise to pay. They didn't have to do anything else other than to deliver a check. And that's the triggering event that would have caused my client to decide, he could have decided to reject the check, and it would have been an entirely different case. But it was never something that was given to my client to decide. It was nothing more than a letter saying, I'm going to promise to pay you, just like I promised to pay you 3 years ago.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If it may please the court, Robert Blaine on behalf of Telemark Development Group, the appellee cross appellant. I'd first like to address a couple of the issues that counsel argued. First is this question of a tender. Counsel said that a tender is an unconditional payment. That's not the way it's defined. In the case that they cite, the Brown and Kerr case, the court said, and I quote, tender is an unconditional offer. That's exactly what the March 7th letter was, an unconditional offer to pay the entire principal and all of the interest all the way up until April 15th, which was actually 15 or a month and a half after the offer that they had made. Regarding the refusal to accept the payment, the defendant, when he got this letter, not only didn't say, okay, I'll take the money, he said, I demand you pay me $200,000, more than 2.5 times the amount of the note, if you want your stock back. Because as he testified himself, at this point in time, he knew the stock was worth at least $1.5 million. He wanted $200,000 to give that stock back. The defendants in their brief call that hard bargaining. I think extortion would be a better word. There was certainly a refusal to pay.
That's what I guess bothers me about this whole thing. It seems to me if he's making a demand for something more than what is on this delinquent note, it seems to me there's a dispute and there's a settlement offer, as opposed to, well, you would just unilaterally extend the term of the note for 2 years or more, and then say, here's the interest that would be owed if you had extended this for 2 years. He's saying, I thought, but he says he's not, that this was not that. I owed a lot more because I should have been paid 2 years ago, and I would have been able to invest it, and I'm damaged because of this. And because you're delinquent, you can't then, it can't be some kind of an equitable thing when you were delinquent in the first place. I guess you can't ask for equity if you're not doing it. So I guess I'm confused as how this got into a tender or no tender as opposed to a settlement offer and a not being able to come up with a settlement.
Well, what happened is the note came due on April 15th, 1998. Pursuant to the terms of the note, upon default, the defendant had the right to do certain things.
I see.
One of which was to transfer the stock to himself. But he didn't do that. He did nothing back in 98. So the note just sat there.
He actually could have transferred the stock to himself.
He could have.
He had that power.
He had that power.
Okay,
within the note.
I didn't know that.
Or he could have sued to collect the amount due. He had several options, but he did nothing.
Well, if the stock were worth all that, he was pretty dumb not to transfer it to himself.
It wasn't in 98.
Oh, wasn't it?
No.
I mean, it was only then and not 2 years later that he could have done that?
Well, he could have done it at any time.
Yeah, well.
When
it went to $2 million, that would have seemed to be the right approach, wouldn't it?
I think I would have done that, but
yeah,
he didn't.
Okay.
Next, on the issue of speculation, there was ample evidence in the record of the price of the stock on a daily basis after the offer on March 7th. There was ample evidence of the liquidity of the trading. There were hundreds of thousands of shares being traded. It would have been very easy to have sold it. To the extent there is any uncertainty as to what the plaintiff would have done had they gotten the stock back, the defendant brought that uncertainty upon himself. He's the one that defaulted, did not return the stock. So he cannot now be heard to say, well, I don't think the plaintiff would have sold the stock if I would have given it back to him.
Did your client testify that he had no interest in selling the stock?
Absolutely not.
He did not testify
that? He did not testify.
On five different occasions?
What he testified to is they had 56,000 shares of stock. They had that. Not the 160,000 shares that the defendant had. They had another 56,000 shares of stock. They said they wanted to hold on to that to see how the company was going to do. They never said that they were not going to sell the 160,000 shares that the defendant had. Never. Also, on this issue of the restrictive legend on the certificate, under Rule 144 of the SEC, the restriction had expired because the stock had been issued more than 2 years earlier. They were perfectly free to sell the stock. As far as removing the legend, it's just as if the stock was in Telemark's name. If they sold the stock, the buyer would have to send in the certificate, get a new one in their name. Same thing with getting the legend removed. It doesn't mean you can't sell it. It just means you have to send in the certificate and get a new one without the restriction. Finally, just briefly, I'd like to address the issues which we have raised. One is the amount of the damages. It is our argument that the stock should have been valued on March 8, 2000, the day after they made the offer, which was rejected. The Alamissa's case, which we cited in several others, clearly hold that a defendant should not be able to benefit from his own wrongdoing. Judge Shader valued the stock 41 days after the breach. The stock was in serious decline at that point. It went from $10 a share to, I think, $3.25 a share 41 days later.
You had, your client had proposed to pay interest on this note to a date certain, I was about a month later, if I'm not mistaken.
About a month and a half, April 15th.
Well, isn't that some evidence at least that your client anticipated that the actual payment and return of the stock would be at some date after this communication was sent? He's going to pay interest on this through a date in the future.
I think they were simply making sure that they were paying everything that was due. There's nothing significant, and I think the trial court held.
Why would it be less speculative to say that the presumed date of transfer was the date upon which interest was being paid? That's the date that Telemark thought this whole transaction would be accomplished. Why? What's speculative about that as opposed to say the day after this? What really is nothing more than a statement of intent to pay at a date future was made.
Well, certainly there is uncertainty as to the date.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that very important in terms of the value of the stock?
It is very important. But I think what I said earlier was that the defendant should not be able to benefit from his own wrongdoing. He's the one that rejected the tender. Now he's arguing, well, you should value the stock way down the road because we don't know what the plaintiff might have done.
If you had received the stock the day after you sent this communication, or when this communication was received, day after the communication was received, could you have sold it right away?
Absolutely.
How, given the legend that was on the stock?
The legend does not prevent the sale. The restriction had expired. The fact that there was writing on the stock certificate itself doesn't prevent it from being sold. I think the SEC release, which we cited in our brief, pointed that out. You can sell it. It's just then the buyer has to get a new certificate. It's sort of like buying a car. You've got a car title. You've got to send it to the Secretary of State and get a new one. But it doesn't prevent a sale. So, yes, they could have sold it immediately. The other point I wanted to make was that the lower court did not award interest on the judgment. Under the Uberndale case, and there are many others, it's held that in a case of conversion, interest should be awarded from the date of the conversion to the date of the judgment. And we believe that should have taken place in this case, and it didn't. If there are no further questions, I thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. All right. Court will take the case under advisement. We have to